محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Israeli protests, Israeli army reservists have stopped reporting for duty. But that is not the most important issue facing Israel. There's also growing divisions among the officials. Looking at the scenes of these protests, some have come to the conclusion that Israel is in a state of civil war. In this edition of the program, we ask, is that really the case? Well, what is for certain is that Israelis are in a state of anger, with some deciding that Israel is not even worth living in, based on a recent poll, opting to migrate out of the occupied territories altogether. Top of all this is what ratings agency Moody's has called significant risk looming over the Israeli economy. Let's discuss all of that with our guests. First, let me introduce them. Keaton Mansfield, journalist and political commentator, joins us from Austin, Texas. Also joining us is Jamal Juma. He's the founder and coordinator at Stop the Wall campaign, who joins us from occupied Ramallah. All right, welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Keaton Mansfield, and ask you about this so-called judicial reform that's happening and the approval that has taken place at this point. Just give us, a synopsis of what has occurred that has continued now to up the anger of the Israelis who are out in protest.
Netanyahu is at risk or has been indicted, and so he and the Likud party about a year ago proposed this unprecedented overhaul of the judicial system that would basically castrate the entirety of Israel's Supreme Court, rendering Netanyahu and his party as a de facto single-party state of Israel. And so initially when he proposed this, there was massive upheaval. A lot of the military reserve said that they would not report in for duty. The largest labor union in Israel threatened to go on strike and completely bring down the economy of Israel. And so Netanyahu backed up a little bit and has decided now instead that this so-called judicial reform will be passed in segments, bit by bit. However, I think the effect will still be the same.
What's very perplexing and confusing, but maybe that's somewhat the aim at this point, where the ultimate goal here is that there won't be a judicial system that it can override cabinet decisions, and that basically this cabinet is going to have decisions made that it can follow through with, and it's not going to have that oversight or anything that can overpower it. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would certainly say so. Yeah, this is Netanyahu's, for his own personal motivations to avoid any sort of legal persecution, as well as it represents the rift between the more liberal and so-called progressive forces within the Israeli government and the hardline traditional forces that that Likud seems to represent. And so I think you kind of have a split between the more nationalistic Jews and the international Jews in the Israeli political system. Essentially, what Netanyahu is setting up to do is to launch a sort of perversion of the Sauline and the Davidic kingdom of the Israelites from, you know, 3,000 years ago by getting rid of the judicial system, getting rid of the judges, and replacing it where Netanyahu can call the shots. He can rule Israel as he sees fit. And for the rest of the world, this is of the utmost urgency to stop.
All right, Joel Juma, so you heard what he said, and if you agree with him, to rule the occupied territories, which has been given the name Israel, based on how he sees it. I mean, what does that spell for Palestinians? We know what this extreme cabinet has said. We know what their views are, as extreme as they are. At this point, leaves out, I guess, gives them a green light to do what they want, doesn't it?
I think yes, and more than that, I think all what Netanyahu is doing, and he and also the fascist parties, the right-wing parties, like led by Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, now is mainly to accelerate the annexation of the West Bank. Which is going on the ground, by the way. Like, and it's like what the settlers is doing now, attacking the Palestinian villages and communities everywhere, particularly in the Area C, targeting the Bedouin communities, pushing them out from the areas. Like, any this year we witnessed 8 communities that has been left their places under the pressure of this fascist settlers. Backed by the Israeli army. So what they want from this judicial system is now to be in their hands to facilitate as quickly as possible this annexation and to remove any obstacle that can delay this annexation. Because you know that this is from ideological point of view for this right-wing parties, that this is like an Israel from the Red to the Sea. And it should be a full sovereignty and shouldn't be a Palestinians have any identity in this land. For that, they were creating this colonial apartheid system now, ghettoizing the Palestinians in the residential areas while trying to the vast majority of the West Bank to be annexed to Israel to enable them to control once and for all the whole area.
Sure.
So. Yeah.
Okay. You mentioned settlers, and I have to ask you, Keen Mansfield, whether you see an association when it comes to settlers and the power that's been given now and promoted by this extreme cabinet in terms of being not only aggressive against Palestinians, which they have been in the past and they've carried through, but also they have increased the call for violence against Palestinians, and how that may constitute with this terminology, which has been used, which many are now acknowledging that is what's unfolding, and that's the civil war. Because they say that these settlers are going to attack Palestinians, which they are. They're going to use their weapons, which does not get confiscated after they've used it against Palestinians. There used to be a law, but now they've abolished that law. And my ultimate question here, if you see the connection, is what is this civil war notion? Are we looking at that unfolding right now?
Yeah, well, it goes farther than just an increase of Israeli settlements, civilian settlements, colonies in the West Bank. About a year ago, the head rabbi for Sephardic Jews in Israel went public with this map of Greater Israel, which essentially expands the borders to include the Sinai Peninsula, include all of Syria, all of Lebanon, all the way up bordering against Turkey. And so I think this is the drive for Netanyahu, is to completely cripple the Muslim powers in the Middle East. And as a response for that, he can proceed with having the Dome of the Rock completely destroyed, the Third Temple built, and of course, which spells the end of the world for the rest of us, the rise of the Antichrist if the Third Temple is constructed. So yes, this a civil war breaking out in Israel is probably the best thing that could ever happen for the rest of the world, because if Netanyahu, if Likud Party gets its way, the entirety of the Muslim world will be crippled in a devastating war and another war of Israeli expansion, which needs to be avoided at all costs. And so ideally, Israel will overplay its hand, as it often does, and internal difficulties, internal problems, will lead to the end of this false state, this fake country that has existed since the 1940s. Hopefully we are going to see it within, ideally, the next year.
Well, there are many who are hoping that, but it's interesting that you bring that up, because many might not have even voiced it the way that you did. And Jamal, it's interesting that our guest there said that this civil war would be one of the best things for the world, especially the Muslim world, and in particular the Palestinians. So tell us if you agree with that, and put that into context for us, how that may benefit this, at least this area in the West Asia region that some refer to it as the Middle East.
Yeah, so far I can agree with this. Like, and the evidence is like this state that has been established in the 40s, it's established on racism. It is a deep racist country. It maybe mostly it's shown against the Palestinians. It's their racism, but like the Palestinians most suffering from this. But as well, they are internally, they are a racist society. There is racism within the society itself. The domination of this white Zionist Ashkenazi that came from the background of the colonial powers in last century in Europe. And also the Eastern Jews. Then after that, also the African Jews. Then the Russian Jews. Like, and so the levels of racism in this country is like so deeply rooted and it's very high. So it's now a breakout. It's a breakout in the face of this state. So the cracks that's already there and the division in the society is really very deep. And this, I think it's irreversible. And how things is going now, it's leading to that, like what we saw in the streets now, that could be developed like in the coming months to a street against the street, like the fascist and the right, what's so called the right fascist Zionist against this, what would they call the secular racist Zionist. So the conflict within this is became much more deep. And there is also the cracks in the military, as we saw, they now there's almost like a kind of disobedience started. Like the other like important things that affect this state is the economy, which we see that there is so many companies now is taking out their capital, and they are not, yeah, they don't, they are afraid from continue investing in their country. So how we can expect also the international investment that they were promoting in the last decades? Also, they are now immigrating. So yeah, this state is now in deep crisis, and this crisis will be also in depth more in the coming coming months. And I agree, like this, they might be busy with themselves than launching like massacres and crimes in the either against the Palestinians in Gaza, West Bank, or against some neighboring Arab countries like Lebanon once in a while.
All right. Some of the things that were mentioned there are important ones. I'm sure you agree, Keen Mansfield, which is pulling apart the seams of the Israeli society, from the economy to the military. And I'm going to ask you about the reservist issue, where there is now put in motion, either you have things where these reservists are signing up that they're not going to go through with their reservist status, that they're not going to volunteer any longer. I'd like to ask you how much of an impact that has on the Israeli regime forces altogether when you have this in motion is set to really spread even further beyond the reservists. How does that affect Israel's security, in a sense?
Well, I would imagine that it is having a significant impact on the domestic tranquility of Israeli society. I mean, we know it is, because when this started, when Netanyahu was trying to ramrod this judicial reform through, he got so much pushback from the military, he had to back down, he had to break it up into segments, the tweaks were made to this so-called proposal. But at the same time, I'm very hesitant to go all in that it will be because of maybe younger and more liberal, more hip, more with the times kind of Jews that aren't willing to go out and just try to conquer Syria or try to conquer the rest of occupied Palestine. I very much hesitate to put too much hope into that being what stops Netanyahu from getting his way, because at the end of the day, we've seen this time and time again, when there's any sort of civil discourse and any sort of back and forth within the Israeli government, that even when it looks like it's getting to the breaking points, this apartheid operation of the Israeli state is going to collapse, those in the government and the civilians sort of say, well, you know, at the end of the day, we're all Jews, and so we may disagree with each other, but we have to be loyal to one another. Otherwise, these dirty Palestinians are going to get their way, and this Israeli project is going to fail. So I would say it's certainly good to see some pushback within the military, but you have to remember that this is the IDF, and to ever trust or have hope in the IDF doing what is right would be ignoring a pushing 100-year track record. So be careful, because the Jews, they will side with themselves before they let the Palestinians gain an inch. Okay. And so it's just a warning of caution, I suppose.
Sure. Well, this warning of caution that our guest there, Jamal Juma, is issuing, you would think that what he's saying, in a sense, does hold truth to it. But when you take a look at the protests, which, you know, we rummage through so many of these footages that are coming through from Israel, Jamal Juma, we're seeing people, it's not about the system, it's about the cost of living. People are angry. There's a lot of anger out there. And it's not just about these so-called judicial reforms. They're sick and tired of, especially the ones in Tel Aviv, about the cost of living being so high. They're sick and tired also on the political side of things when it comes to how Israel is never really able to maintain a solid security for its inhabitants on occupied lands. My question to you is, how deep are fissures in Israel where it is almost impossible for it to go back to the status quo of before?
You know, I think it's difficult, because here, the conflict is not on the just on the top level. You are talking about the conflict that has been in the whole society, in the two big bodies of the society. So I expect even if they reform that, this vote that was in the Knesset 2 days ago, I think we will find the crisis. And with the demonstrations, we will see these demonstrations that will start from the right, from the right-wing parties in the streets. So the right-wing parties now, that the it was a golden opportunity that never dreamed of, that one day they will become and control the state and turn it into an ideological Jewish state. That's what they are now. Starting with, and they are not going to give up this easily. So they will fight for this. And that's what I think, what fears the Israeli people themselves. That's what I say, why I say maybe we will find, and that's how the polls is showing, that many people just feel insecure, beside also that the expectation of the deterioration of the economy, if this major companies, especially from the high tech, started to leave, so the economical situation will not be secure or good enough as it was. So what will encourage them to stay, especially when they talk about the security there? This state has built on a security. If the people feel insecure in this state, all what they were promoting to bring Jews to Palestine, that this is the secure place for them. And if they feel that they are not secure anymore, especially internally, from the situation internally, and they are afraid and they are expecting that this conflict is going to become much more confrontational between the streets and inside Israel. Mm-hmm. The military that's supposed to be the main thing that bring them together and give them the security, and all the time they were proud of this military, that undefeatable, that it's very strong, and it's the one who's controlling the rhythm inside Israel. And now there is a serious problem within this army. So there's so many problems on the security wise, economical wise, that will push many people to leave. I'm not talking about the mass immigration left there, but this is will go gradually with the deterioration of the situation. And sure. As I said, because this is irreversible. What that has been done is irreversible. The division inside the society is irreversible, and everyone will be stand strongly behind what they want, either what the right fascist wing achieve now by this when they are in the government, or those secular Zionists who were ruling the states in the last the last 70 years.
All right, Keen Mansfield, our guest there says, in terms of the, he touched on something important here, which I want to ask you, and that's about the migration. Okay, first of all, the stat that we have, the most recent stat which has made news, let me double check and make sure that I'm going to say this correctly. It's a new survey, a third that's a third of Israelis considering moving abroad, okay, based on this judicial reform bill. But I want to tie that in with the economy, of which, when you take a look at the shekel, Israel's money compared to the U.S. is devaluing 6% so far, roughly, that's the average median. But what's more important, and people don't really realize this, many, I don't know if you do or not, but that's the high-tech sector. That's a big sector in Israel. In terms of the stats there, it employs 11% of all employees, responsible for 17% of Israel's GDP, and for 23% of overall direct tax receipts. That sector needs foreign money. It needs investments. There is no investor confidence right now. That sector is being decimated as we speak. And when that happens, you're going to get the migration out of Israel. So my question to you is, when you say don't have so much trust in the reservists, we're looking at an economy that's falling apart. And people are going to migrate out of an economy that's not doing well. No amount of security is going to buy an economy for Israel, if you agree. So are we looking at something, and based on the fact that the protested now for almost 8 months now, are we looking at this really putting a test to Israel altogether?
Well, I should certainly hope so. If you have a third of your population considering or having basically fled your country after your entire sales pitch for existence is a good, stable, and prosperous place for the Jews to go, and now you turn around and you have a third of the population on the brink of abandoning your state, you're going to be in a serious issue. You've lost literally a third of your manpower, which then raises the concern for me that oftentimes when countries start to have economic issues, when there's an economic downturn or there's the risk of one, or people are losing faith in the government, they feel insecure, they feel like their lives are endangered, the state very well may turn itself towards a war-based economy. Netanyahu or the Likud party, or even if it were the more liberal, progressive, so-called secular Zionist forces, may see that the only real way to move forward is with some sort of mobilization of the IDF to sweep in and occupy the rest of Palestine, to drive every single Arab that they can find out of the West Bank, out of their rightful homeland altogether.
Let me jump in, and I'm sorry to interrupt you because I got to squeeze the last question due to lack of time to John Aljoma. If they decide to do that, what do you think? Do you think maybe that would be actually a nail in the coffin if Israel decides to move in and do what our guest there just said in regards to Palestinians? Less than a minute, please.
Yeah, I think they are thinking of this, especially when you talk about Smotrich and his plan that has been launched. Yeah, they were thinking of this, but I don't think that this is easy now. Israel is not in its best cases to do such an amass like Nakba, like in 48 in the Palestinian area. The Palestinians much more stronger than that time, and Israel and internationally and is not as supported as it was in that time. So, and okay, it's not going to be something easy that they will do, and this will be the end for Israel. They can't export the problem with like a mass expulsion and of the Palestinian people.
Thank you very much. Sorry to break you there, but we're just out of time. Jamal Joma, founder and coordinator of Stop the Wall campaign. Keaton Mansfield, thank you. Journalist and political commentator from Austin. Thank you so much. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Let me cover Tawai and the team. It's goodbye.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the verses of Chapter Nur, the 24th chapter of the Holy Quran, and different commentary points of these verses. Brothers and sisters, let's listen to the 22nd verse of Chapter Nur.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم ولا يأتل أولو الفضل منكم والسعة أن يؤتوا أولي القربى والمساكين والمهاجرين في سبيل الله وليعفوا وليصفحوا ألا تحبون أن يغفر الله لكم والله غفور رحيم.
And let not those of virtue among you and wealth swear not to give aid to their relatives and the needy and the immigrants for the cause of Allah, and let them pardon and overlook. Would you not like that Allah should forgive you? And Allah is forgiving and merciful.
Brothers and sisters, some commentators have narrated an occasion of revelation for this holy verse, which shows how this verse is related to the previous verses which were about the subject of ifk. It is said that this holy verse was revealed about some companions of Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam. After the event of ifk, they took an oath to withdraw their financial helps from anyone who was involved in that event, from anyone who was involved in spreading that great calumny. They decided to give them no generous succor in anything, of course, but this noble verse prevented them from this violation and harshness. It orders them to be forgiving, to be lenient, because if they want to be forgiven by the Almighty Allah, they must forgive themselves. They must to try to be, in some aspects, to be closer like the characteristics of the Almighty Allah. Of course, there are other occasions of revelation mentioned for this verse. Some Sunni commentators insist that this verse is revealed about Abu Bakr, who terminated his financial help to the one who was involved in that very incident. I mean, the incident of ifk. They say that Abu Bakr terminated his financial help to Maslah ibn Athatha, who helped the circulation of ifk. Some believe that this is true, but it seems that all pronouns that are used in the verse are plural. And this matter somehow could indicate that a group of Muslims decided to put an end to their helps onto these wrongdoers, and Abu Bakr could be one of them. But anyway, this verse prohibits all of the Muslims, I mean a group of Muslims, from this decision. Anyway, we know that the verses of the Holy Quran are not limited. We know that the verses of the Holy Quran are not limited to the occasions of revelation. They involve all believers till doomsday. And this holy verse implicitly recommends Muslims not to be influenced by hot feelings, and they should not make rough and excessive decisions against wrongdoers, errors, and faults.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So, dear listeners, after mentioning the occasion of revelation, we return to the commentary of the verse. The Holy Quran says, وَلَا يَأْتَلِ أُولُو الْفَضْلِ مِنْكُمْ وَالسَّعَةِ أَنْ يُؤْتُوا أُولِي الْقُرْبَى وَالْمَسَاكِينَ وَالْمُهَاجِرِينَ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ And let not those who possess dignity and ease among you swear against giving to the near of kin and the needy and the fugitives for the cause of Allah. وَلْيَعْفُوا وَلْيَصْفَحُوا They should pardon, they should overlook. The Arabic word safh means to ignore, which is more important than forgiveness. Some have said that safh is a kind of forgiveness which is without rebuke and reproof. And the way of saying of this verse shows that a group of those who were involved in Ifk incident were from among the emigrants in the way of Allah. They were deceived by those hypocrites, and because of their past records, Allah did not allow them to be driven away from Islamic society. And He subhanahu wa ta'ala did not let the Muslims decide some horrible things about them that were more than the limit they deserved. Anyway, this holy phrase in this verse, لَا يَأْتَلِ أُولُو الْفَضْلِ مِنْكُمْ لَا يَأْتَلِ is whether derived from the word إِلِيَّ meaning to take an oath, or from the word alb, meaning to abandon and to shrink. Anyway, the verse prohibits taking an oath to terminate such helps. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Multipolar world and invasive security were the main headlines of the talks that Russian President Vladimir Putin held with African leaders. Other issues were also discussed in the summit, including the food security. Withdrawal from the grain deal with Ukraine will allow Russia to accelerate the research of relations with African states. The food issue is exactly what the authorities can cling on to restore the ties lost after the collapse of the USSR. Representatives of African countries see Russia as a reliable partner, and thanks to this, Moscow has a good chance to firmly gain a foothold on the continent again. Putin has repeatedly stressed that Russia is ready to work together, hand in hand with African friends, to work for the future, to build a truly strategic interaction and partnership.
In the coming months, in the next 3 to 4 months, we will be ready to provide Burkina Faso, Zimbabwe, Mali, Somalia, the Central African Republic, Eritrea, with 25,000 tons of grain and fertilizer free of charge, and we will also provide free delivery of these products to consumers.
Moscow has once again written off $23 billion as part of African debt relief, implementing energy projects in 30 African countries, and is ready to settle accounts with African countries in national currencies. The descendants of prominent African leaders announced the creation of the Pan-African Anti-Colonial Legacy Forum. Among them are the descendants of Nelson Mandela, Gamal Abdel Nasser, Ahmed Ben Bella, Julius Nyerere, Samora Machel. New branches of Russian universities will be opened in Africa together with the enrollment increase of African students in Russian universities.
Russia has delayed its return to Africa. We should have done this earlier, especially since Moscow has such a good heritage in Africa. In Soviet times, Moscow has always supported liberation movements in Africa, supported humanitarian and economically. The USSR built a lot in Africa, developed a huge number of projects. After the USSR collapse, Russia was deceived in its choice of a pro-Western vector. The result is the expansion of NATO countries by the border. Moscow is once again resuming its relations with Africa countries when the grain deal is completed and African countries again nations help.
The Russia-Africa summit was attended by representatives of those countries which and presented the majority of the African.
With Russia's strong return, an opportunity to completely get rid of Western colonial and also now tap into their natural resources and benefit from Russian experience in various fields such as security, agriculture and energy to fuel the growth of their countries. Marina Kartanova, Moscow.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol celebrated the 70th anniversary of the signing of the Korean War Armistice, honoring veterans of the war visiting Busan for the event. President Yoon again emphasized the importance of the country's alliance with the United States.
South Korea, as a responsible member of the international community, will stand in solidarity with free democratic countries. Also, with the South Korea-U.S. alliance as the linchpin, will protect peace, freedom, and prosperity of not only the Indo-Pacific region, but the whole world.
Still, many see President Yoon's strengthening of the alliance, resumption of large-scale military drills, and deployments of U.S. nuclear-capable ships and aircraft creating a barrier between North Korea and South Korea. North Korea remains under U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions over its missile and nuclear programs. sanctions which critics say only hinder the country's economic development. Near the border with North Korea, NGO leaders from around the world called for the armistice to be replaced with a peace treaty.
We are here because after 70 years, the Korean people deserve peace. We are here because people around the world need to hear more about the impacts today of this ongoing war, including the very real human impacts. We believe that sanctions and pressure will not resolve the situation, but instead we need dialogue and cooperation.
North Korea, meanwhile, this week celebrated the armistice as a victory over the U.S. and South Korea, as congratulatory delegations from China and Russia visited Pyongyang. The fortified border of the DMZ is just a few kilometers along National Road Number 1 behind me, across Unification Bridge. Despite the cycles of military tension, these symbols suggest there are many people in South Korea, likely North Korea, and around the world that remain optimistic about efforts toward peaceful relations. Frank Smith, Paju, South Korea.
In the midst of Iraq's 1980s war on Iran, the terrorist Mojahedin-e-Khalq organization, a key ally of Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist regime, launched a brutal attack to overthrow the Islamic establishment in Iran. The attack that took place on July 26, 1988, was the Saddam regime's last attempt to score gains after the Iraqi forces failed to capture even an inch of the Iranian territory during almost 8 years of war. Saddam's regime and the MEK came up with a ferocious blitz aimed at infiltrating from the central western borders of Iran into Kermanshah province. It meant to capture the capital, Tehran, execute the political leadership, and announce a power grab before Iranian reinforcement troops could be dispatched from the country's southwest. The MEK had joined the Iraqi operations since the early years of the war, but this time it wanted its own members to perform the operation. The Iraqi regime had provided 7,500 members of the terror cult with modern weapons and military equipment. The new strategy aimed to win the support of the Iranian people and establish an MEK-run puppet regime in Tehran, but to no avail. Iranian people regard the MEK members as invasive aggressors, so they responded to them by live fire. It was a surprise attack, as it occurred just days after Tehran and Baghdad accepted a UN resolution that ended the war and the front line was relatively calm. However, Saddam's ill intentions were met by fierce resistance from the Iranian people and armed forces. Iran's military launched a counterattack codenamed Operation Mersad and foiled the MEK operation just within 3 days by inflicting nearly 5,000 casualties on the terrorist group's members. Operation Mersad is of the essence in the region's history, as it is the last battle during the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran. It dashed Saddam's hopes of defeating Iran and thwarted the MEK's sinister ambitions. The MEK, now based in Albania, has carried out numerous terrorist attacks against Iranian civilians and government officials since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Out of nearly 17,000 Iranians killed in terrorist attacks over the past four decades, about 12,000 have fallen victim to the MEK's acts of terror. The European Union, Canada, the United States, and Japan had previously listed the MEK as a terrorist organization. In 2012, the group was taken off the U.S. list of terrorist organizations. The EU followed suit, removing the group from its list of terrorist organizations. Washington and its allies even give the terrorist group all-out logistical and monetary support, hosting its meetings on their territories while speaking of human rights and world peace.
Thank you.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's Air Force has wrapped up the 11th edition of aerial drills codenamed Defenders of Velayat Sanctuary. During the two-day nationwide maneuvers, Air Force units conducted a full range of operations and exercised various tactics using drones, fighter jets, transport, logistical, and refueling aircraft, as well as air ambulances. The operations were conducted over various areas from the Persian Gulf to the northwestern and northeastern regions. The main stage of the drills kicked off in the central province of Isfahan on Sunday night, as fighter jets and bombers carried out nocturnal operations and detonated the mock enemy's ground targets with Qasid-upgraded standoff missiles. The Iranian military drones also conducted major operations. Various combat, reconnaissance and electronic warfare UAVs such as Kaman 12, Karar, Mohajer 6 and Arash destroyed targets using different modified bombs with pinpoint accuracy. On the sideline of the drills in Isfahan, the chief of staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, hailed the Air Force for achieving the main objectives of the maneuvers, saying the country's military preparedness prevents enemies from taking any hostile action.
The Army's Air Force has provided a very suitable and acceptable level of security for Iran's airspace from the north to the Strait of Hormuz and the three islands of the Greater Tomb, Lesser Tomb, and Abu Musa. With this level of readiness, no enemy has the capability to penetrate and violate the airspace of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Major General Bagheri also said the power, readiness, and vigilance of the Air Force will constantly improve, promising a brighter future ahead. Iranian military experts and technicians have in recent years made substantial headway in manufacturing a broad range of indigenous equipment, making the armed forces self-sufficient. Homegrown Iranian military products have also found many clients in the world. Iranian officials have repeatedly warned that the country will not hesitate to strengthen its military capabilities, which are entirely meant for defense.
This massive exercise is aimed at bolstering preparedness of the Iranian Air Force. It also serves as a clear warning message to the enemies of the Islamic Republic against any act of aggression. Mahdi Abbasian, Anorak.
The United States Federal Reserve raised the interest rate once again, reaching its highest level in 22 years, with no indication for when it will return to normal.
We'd be comfortable cutting rates when we're comfortable cutting rates, and that won't be this year, I don't think. Inflation remains well above a longer-run goal of 2%. Growth in consumer spending appears to have slowed from earlier in the year. Although activity in the housing sector has picked up somewhat, it remains well below levels of a year ago, largely reflecting higher mortgage rates.
Low consumer spending spells major trouble for an economy in which consumer spending provides 70% of GDP. The housing sector just saw its first price decline in 6 years, and housing is the primary financial asset for the average family.
A well-known byproduct of prolonged high interest rates is that it will cause precarious businesses to go bankrupt and provoke mass unemployment. Data shows this is already taking place.
Corporate bankruptcies just hit their highest first-half levels since 2010. Planned layoffs are at the highest first-half levels since 2009. The damage done by prolonged high interest rates is revealed by the highest level in years for credit card, car loan, and other debt, and all while still failing to reduce record prices for the most basic goods.
People are suffering from it, and a lot of more people are going to food banks to get food because they can't afford to buy a lot of the food. And also the government has cut food subsidies for people who in need.
Despite the economic hardship, Washington has ended key coronavirus-era programs, with health insurance just revoked for millions of people. States are reporting their first increases in years for their poverty rates, all of which contributes to President Joe Biden's near-record-low approval rating.
Yeah, they might cause Biden to lose the election because he's not doing enough about inflation. I'm sure he knows that. I mean, people are going to, whatever, if it's going to be Trump versus Biden or whoever, people are going to vote for where the economic situation, where they think it's going to be better. Because most people see the two parties as being the same.
There are other ways to curb excessive prices that don't burden the working class, such as price controls, limiting corporate profits, preventing price gouging, and increasing wages. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
During the first 10 days of the Islamic month of Muharram, culminating in Tasawwuf and Ashura, eulogists recite the events of the Battle of Karbala, and Islamic scholars elaborate on the underlying message of Imam Hussein's stance against tyranny.
Tasawwuf is the ninth day of the lunar month of Muharram. It is considered a very important religious occasion as Muslims worldwide commemorate the martyrdom anniversary of the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Ashura, which literally means the 10th of Muharram, is the day Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his 72 companions were martyred in the Battle of Karbala in southern Iraq in 680 AD as they fought courageously for justice against the much larger army of the Umayyad Caliph Yazid I. Imam Hussein alayhi salam is a hero that transcends time. His goodness makes him a moral example for all human beings worldwide, and foreign students at Tehran University have not missed the chance to mourn for the much revered Imam along with the entire Iranian nation.
We all gather here, irrespective of religion. Here in our Hayat, a lot of students who belongs to the different sects like Ahle Sunnah and other sects as well, they work for the love of Imam Hussein.
The very popular phrase, Hubbul Hussein Yajma'ana, this is the actual meaning of it, that everyone from around the world, no matter of their background, can come together and commemorate the martyrdom of Imam Hussein for one message, the message of Islam, the message of the grandfather Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Participating in Hayat means like propagating the message of Imam Hussein, which is justice and unity.
Tearful mourners take part in rituals while educating the younger generation about the sufferings of Imam Hussein. The processions continue until noon. After the prayers, people line up for lunch. Many people consider it an honor to serve the lovers of Imam Hussein, and that is why they give away food not just to the needy, but also to those that have been taking part in the processions.
Cooking for a large crowd is very difficult, but we enjoy serving the lovers of Imam Hussein. It's an honor. Today we served about 3,500 meals.
The positive vibes that we get on this day is simply incomparable to any other experience.
The mourning rituals of Tasawwuf and Ashura are considered an important part of Iranian culture, mostly because of the opportunity to reflect on Imam Hussein's values, his way of life, and what he stood up for. Gizumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
People in Afghanistan have been commemorating Muharram in large gatherings under the rule of the Taliban and amid security challenges. Tasawwuf falls on the ninth day of the Islamic month and is devoted to Imam Hussein's brother, Abul Fazl al-Abbas. To mark the occasion, thousands of mourners converged on one of Kabul's oldest shrines. Participants expressed their affection and devotion to the martyrs of Karbala and honored their sacrifices.
The school of Imam Hussein taught us the lessons of heroism and freedom. Imam and his companions sacrificed themselves in the path of religion, justice, and truth. They stood for the future of Islam and humanity.
In all our processions, we witness both Sunni and Shia people actively taking part. They beat on their chests, recite elegies, and distribute food shoulder to shoulder with each other. This bonding and solidarity is getting stronger year after year as more and more people learn about Imam Hussein and his revolution.
On Ashura, Afghan Muslims closed their businesses and took a day off to grieve over the tragedy of Karbala. Here at Khatam al-Nabiyyin Mosque, people from different backgrounds observed Ashura as a common Islamic heritage. They emphasized the importance of Islamic unity in the face of global arrogance and condemned the recent desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden and Denmark.
We can sum up the message in Gola Ashura in one sentence, and that is resistance against the arrogant and tyrannical ruler of the time. The Afghan people proved that they are the true followers of Imam Ali and Imam Hussein by fighting and defeating the Soviet Union, the British Empire, and the United States.
Insulting the Holy Quran in Sweden and Denmark is an act of hatred and enmity toward Islam and its high values. This heinous act was against all universal and human values, and this was an insult to the sanctities of about 2 billion Muslims in the world. We condemn this insult and want it stopped.
Muharram ceremonies in Afghanistan faced some limitations by the Taliban security forces this year. The Taliban authorities cited security reasons for the measures, but many Shia Muslims are suspicious of their motive. Ashura is the skull of liberty and resistance against tyranny. The ceremonies held here show people have not forgotten the steadfastness and heroism of Imam Hussein and his companions hundreds of years after the tragedy of Karbala. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Ashura. In one of his speeches, he mentioned that the whole unity of expression that was at the base of our victory came about by the grace of these Ashura morning rites and meetings, as well as the sessions for the propagation and spread of Islam. In this part of his speech, obviously, he's talking about the importance of Ashura. And on top of that, he is talking about the importance of the victory and the main reason of the victory that they had over the previous king. In order to have this Islamic revolution, Imam Khomeini has said that it is because of the Ashura, the morning rites and meetings that we had. In these morning rites, we learned how Imam Hussein alayhi salam and those who were on the right path, how they struggled, how they were steadfast against the taghut, against the falsehood. And this is what we need to learn from the Ashura.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi sallallahu alayhi. Ya Rasulullah, صلي على الله النبي وآله.
We need to learn it from the Ashura that whenever